shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
For some years, I've been talking to you folks about things that are in the Bible, and tonight I decided to talk about the Bible itself, how we got it, where it came from, what they did with it in the process. As you know, of course, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew. Now, we have no record of or any reason to believe that there were different versions of the Hebrew back in Old Testament days. There was no reason for it. They had the original manuscripts to start with, and they were copied carefully by the scribes. And while human errors would no doubt creep in occasionally, a slip of the pen or a careless copyist omitting a word or something of that sort, in general, they maintained a pretty thorough accuracy. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a practically complete Book of Isaiah, and there is not one important difference from the Book of Isaiah as we have it today. In Old Testament days, we have no indication that they ever tried to put it all together as one book, the Old Testament. The writings of the different prophets were separate books, and they weren't in book form as we know it today, a number of pages bound along one margin, but they were in scroll form, some of them on papyrus. Besides the authentic writings, why, of course, there have been, in every age of which we have any record at all, religious cranks who like to put forth their views. And there were some of those in ancient times, too. And while no doubt some people believed some of these things, the general good judgment rejected them. Now, you've heard the term canon used. It signifies the group of books that are recognized as authentic. There's a canon of the Old Testament and a canon of the New Testament. And by 120 B.C., the canon of the recognized books of the Old Testament was pretty well settled. Now, it's true that an official canon wasn't adopted until about 100 A.D., but nonetheless, everybody knew from 120 B.C., that certain books were accepted as authentic and others were rejected as not being inspired. This went on with the Hebrew Old Testament in common use, and you might note something about the Hebrew writing. Prior to the Babylonian captivity, they used an entirely different alphabet, which has been commonly known as Phoenician, because the first examples of it that we found in modern times were from Phoenician cities. But we know now that that same alphabet was used in Jerusalem prior to the Babylonian captivity. When they came back from the Babylonian captivity, most of them were using the square letter Hebrew alphabet as it's recognized today. Now, the old so-called Phoenician alphabet wasn't entirely abandoned. The inscriptions on some coins issued during the Maccabee period from, say, 150 B.C. are in the old so-called Phoenician alphabet. But in general, it was abandoned and forgotten. Now, in the square letter Hebrew, they originally had only the consonant letters. Vowels were not developed and used until, well, the earliest record we have would be roughly 700 A.D. It did involve some problems. To parallel it in English, suppose you take the letters B, T. Does it mean bat? Does it mean bet? Does it mean bit or bite or boat or butt? What vowel you put in there can make a great deal of difference in meaning. Now, of course, as far as the scriptures were concerned, they were supposed to be, and except for some periods of apostasy in the priesthood, they were in constant study and constant use in the temple, and the Levites were all supposedly familiar with this and scattered through the country teaching the people. So where there was room for possible doubt, you could change a word by changing a vowel in it. It didn't actually make a practical problem during that time, because everybody that had occasion to use these scrolls knew what it was supposed to be. About 100 A.D., there was an official Jewish adoption of a canon. They repudiated the Greek Septuagint, partly because the Septuagint translated, probably around 285 to 250 or so B.C., included some apocryphal books that were not recognized in the Hebrew canon. And there were some other differences also. You remember, the Hebrew canon wasn't recognized even unofficially till about 120 B.C. So you have the Septuagint nearly a century and a half before that, and they included these other books of, to be charitable, very doubtful value. Now, along with the adoption of an official canon, there was an official text, the Sopharim text. Sopher means scribe. And you have this definite profession of scribes, and while undoubtedly they had occasion to do some writing of commercial manuscripts and contracts, that sort of thing, but their chief occupation was the copying of scrolls of the scriptures. And they adopted some elaborate rules to prevent errors in copying. On each line, they would note the number of words and then the number of letters in that line. And when the scribe had made his copy, he was to count up and see that if the number of letters and the number of words were identical, in addition to just reading it over to see if it apparently made the same sense as the original. Now, it was recognized that there would be some errors, some slips of the pen. If these were not serious, if they didn't change the meaning, they were allowed to get by, though the rule was if more than three errors of any kind were found in the page, it had to be discarded. When, from a century earlier than that, you have this manuscript of Isaiah in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and with no significant difference from what we have today, you can see that their rules to prevent copying errors worked reasonably well. In fact, the copying errors really became serious from about 700 A.D. on. That was the Masoretic text. Masora means tradition. And so this was the traditional text. It was a revision of the Sopharim text. The big change was that at this time they added the vowel letters to give the traditional pronunciation that the school of the scribes and rabbis at Tiberias had had for many generations. In the Hebrew, you started with nothing but the consonant letters, and they were written on the line and close together, and there was no room to put vowel letters in between them. In fact, they were written so close together that in many of the manuscripts, it's a little bit of a problem to decipher them because there wasn't even a significant space between words. Now what to do when you want to add vowel letters? So they developed a number of little vowel letters about the size of periods and commas, which were written underneath the line. far as any serious errors are concerned, really started with the Masoretic text about 700 A.D. It was revised and corrected in the 10th century A.D. by Ben Asher. That's the final form of the Masoretic text in use today, and substantially all are current Bibles that base the Old Testament on the Hebrew manuscripts are based on this Masoretic text as revised by Ben Asher. It's interesting to note what the scribes did in copying these manuscripts. Suppose a scribe is copying from a manuscript where he doesn't think that's what the word ought to be. Let's suppose it's a case where the mistake is so glaringly obvious that it just doesn't make good sense at all, the way it's written. Could the scribe correct it? Not by changing the manuscript. He copied the error. No matter how obvious, he copied it exactly. Then out in the margin, he wrote the correction, what the word should be, so that in reading it, you would come across in the text the erroneous word, but then from the margin you would pick up the word that it should be. It was the right way to handle the thing, undoubtedly, because if you began letting every scribe use his personal judgment as to whether that word ought to be changed in the text or not, then you would get into problems. So they handled it the best way they could. Now, you remember that when the northern kingdom, Israel, went into captivity, the Assyrians brought other people, mostly from around Babylon, and settled them in Samaria. These pagans who were moved in, they'd been praying to their own gods and nothing happened. So they sent word back to Assyria, "We don't know how to worship the god of this land who will take care of this wild animal problem for us, so send us a priest from some of the Israelite captives." Now, they kept their paganism, but they tried to adopt in addition to it the Old Testament worship as they understood it. They even eventually set up a rival temple. If you read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you'll see the problems that came when the people returned to build Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity. The people of Samaria said, "Well, we'll join with you in helping to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem because we also worship Yahweh." But the returned exiles would have nothing to do with them. They weren't racially of any tribe of Israel, and they still had some paganism in their religion. Of what scriptures they had, the only thing that has survived to us today is a Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Well, there are several of these known. The earliest existing copy today dates from about the 10th century. It's written in the old so-called Phoenician script, so evidently they had gotten a hold of a copy that hadn't been destroyed at the time of the Babylonian conquest. Now, it is not exactly the same as either the Hebrew as we have it today or the Greek translation, the Septuagint, but it does shed some light on what they had back in those ancient times. Now, another thing you may read about are the Targums. Now, these are not translations. They are paraphrases. The scriptures, of course, the Old Testament, were written in Hebrew, and they remained in Hebrew. Now, when the people came back from Babylon, Hebrew was a dead language, except to the priests and scribes. They knew Hebrew because they were working constantly with the manuscripts of the Old Testament scriptures. The rest of the people spoke Aramaic. Now, Aramaic is another Semitic dialect, closely related to Hebrew, but not identical with it. Nevertheless, there are some different words, some different pronunciations, and in the synagogues, when the scriptures were read, most of the people couldn't understand it in the Hebrew. So, a verse or two would be read in the Hebrew. Then somebody had to translate it into Aramaic for the benefit of the congregation. At first, they only allowed oral translations from the Hebrew into the Aramaic. Later, they allowed the use of written translations for private study only. They wouldn't allow a written translation into Aramaic to be read in the synagogue, because that would seem to be putting it on a par with the Hebrew manuscript. Oh, the Talmud records an incident later than 100 A.D. in which a Targum manuscript was confiscated and destroyed because it had been used beyond the permissible manner. Eventually, however, they were allowed to have these written Aramaic translations even for use in the synagogue. Now, what they did, they didn't make just a literal translation. They started out, to begin with, using a paraphrase to make it clearer, because even the idiom of the Hebrew is not always identical with the idiom of the Aramaic. So they would rephrase it to make it a little bit clearer, and the writer of the Targum, trying to make it clear, would add his own additional explanations and arguments, so that in the Targums, basically, you don't have a translation at all. You have a paraphrase, a rephrasing in the writer's own idea of what the original meant, no matter what it said. And they are therefore of no value at all as any guide to what the early Hebrew manuscript said. But, as I say, the Masoretic text has come down to us with not too many errors. Most of the differences between the different manuscripts really come from errors in these tiny little vowel points. True, it changes one word to another, but you can see how it happened. You have the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. According to the tradition, this was translated, the entire Old Testament, in 72 days by 72 Jewish scholars who had been sent from Jerusalem to Alexandria about 270 to 280 B.C. at the request of the Egyptian king Ptolemy Philadelphus. There were two magnificent libraries at Alexandria in Egypt at that time, and the various Egyptian kings were eager to make it the great center of learning of the world. And there is no doubt that the legend, if you want to call it that, is definitely true. To build up the library at Alexandria, they wanted a Greek version of the Old Testament. Now, it's true that a lot of Jews had settled in Alexandria, but nevertheless, most of the people there couldn't read Hebrew, and so they did need a Greek text. Greek had become an important language in Egypt because, you remember, it was part of Alexander the Great's empire, and on the breakup at his death, that was one of the four kingdoms that was established under the Ptolemy kings. We know definitely that the first part of it to be issued were the first five books of the Bible, and the indications are that to complete the Old Testament took several years. Since there was no accepted canon, the Septuagint does, as I said, include some apocryphal books which were rejected in Palestine. Now, as to the quality of the Greek language used in the Septuagint, various parts of the Septuagint show great differences in ability on the part of the translators, great differences in knowledge of the Greek language. Some parts are done in beautifully polished Greek, and some are awkward and bungled because those parts were done by somebody who just simply didn't know his Greek very well. Now, there are a number of differences between the Septuagint and the accepted Hebrew manuscript. As I say, first of all, it includes these apocryphal books which the Hebrew rejected. Secondly, there are quite a number of places where a sentence is broken off in the middle, you might say, in the Septuagint, when it was substantially longer, contained additional words in the Hebrew. And likewise, there are quite a number of sentences in the Septuagint that run on to contain additional material not found in the Hebrew. Then there are a number of word differences which change the meaning quite considerably, and some of them definitely intentional. Others might be just errors of a copyist. A papyrus manuscript, of course, being only a form of paper, naturally wore out after a while. Now, the custom among the Jews was, when a manuscript wore out to the point where it was no longer substantially useful, it was becoming torn or obliterated, it was buried. They would bury it in a cemetery beside the grave of some noted rabbi, or in some cases it was walled up in a synagogue wall. A new copy, of course, had been made to replace it. And the same is true even when you get into the Aramaic manuscripts from farther east, Syria, Babylon, Persia, because it was thought not fitting to let a sacred thing like this simply become trash when it was no longer usable for the purpose for which it was made. Why, it was buried or otherwise destroyed. So if you're wondering, why don't we have any manuscripts of the Old Testament in either Hebrew or Greek going way back thousands of years, like some of the Egyptian papyri that have been found? The answer is no, they were deliberately destroyed. The earliest existing manuscript of the Septuagint probably doesn't go back earlier than 1000 A.D. The earlier ones had served their time and been destroyed. In most of those that we have, where the name of God is mentioned in the Hebrew, Yahweh, in translating it into Greek, they had substituted either the Greek theos, meaning God, or kurios, meaning Lord. However, some quite early fragmentary manuscripts of it have been discovered, in which, although it is written in Greek, where they come to the name of God, Yahweh, those four Hebrew letters are copied into it, and in the old so-called Phoenician Hebrew script. So it shows that at that time, the corruption hadn't fully set in. Now, even Jerome, who wrote the Vulgate translation in Latin in the early part of the 4th century, mentions the Septuagint still using the word Yahweh instead of Kurios. So it shows that the change there was a later corruption. Some of our self-admitted scholars, who like to think themselves infallible, because in Western Europe they had the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, they assure us, oh, it was all originally written in Greek. Oh, everybody in Palestine spoke Greek. It was a universal language. And if they'd only go back and look at the historical records, they would know that they are merely ignorant and stupid. Now, when they came back from the Babylonian captivity, these people realized that they'd gone into that captivity because they had not been faithful to their religion. And they determined to follow it right to the letter with mechanical strictness after they got back. Now, at first, of course, they were ruled as part of the Persian Empire. But then Alexander overthrew the Persian Empire, and upon his death, the Seleucids, who took over the Syrian and Palestinian part of Alexander's empire, they were determined that they were going to make their kingdom Greek in culture. Now, they were pagans, and they tried to dominate Palestine. They tried to compel the adoption of paganism, pagan temples being set up, pagan worship, and of course they were bitterly resisted in Judea. Finally, one Syrian king, Antiochus Epiphanes, determined to stamp out the worship of Yahweh. He invaded and desecrated the temple, that was Ezra's temple, of course, for that time in Jerusalem, sacrificed a pig on the altar, and gave orders that anybody sticking to the old worship was to be killed. Now, that provoked the Maccabee Rebellion. Now, all this sort of thing was done by Greek-speaking people, having Greek pagan culture and trying to enforce Greek paganism and customs on these people in Judea, and they weren't having any of it. So it became bitterly unpopular. The Maccabean Wars were very bitter and the suffering very great under it, and these people came out thoroughly embittered against anything Greek. Josephus brings out that very few people in Judea knew Greek. Josephus says he was one of the very few in Judea who were learned in Greek, as his nation greatly discouraged it. That's in his writing, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 20, Chapter 11. And in his other work, The Jewish Wars, in the preface to it, he says that he wrote it in his country's own language, and that the Parthians, that's part of Persia, the Parthians, the Babylonians, the remotest Arabians, and those of our nation beyond Euphrates, received and read his books in the Aramaic, but that he would now translate it into Greek. In fact, it was said that it was considered as bad to learn Greek as to eat pork. Now, these self-styled scholars who say, oh, everything in the New Testament was written in Greek, they admit that there isn't any part of the New Testament that is Greek in thought or philosophy. There isn't any part of the New Testament that is Greek in its idiom or phraseology. It's all Aramaic in its idiom. So they say, well now, these people all spoke Greek. It was their universal language. But they never thought in Greek. They thought in Aramaic. Now that alone is enough to disqualify any man from the claim to be a scholar. Anybody who's ever studied a foreign language, if you've had so much as a year of high school French or something of that sort, you know that the hardest part of learning any foreign language is learning to think in it. In the early stages, when you want to say something in the language you're learning, you have to think it out in English and then mentally translate it before you can speak it. So this idea that they thought in Aramaic but wrote in Greek refutes itself very definitely. Now, there were some later Greek translations after the Septuagint. About 140 to 150 A.D., Aquila made a translation from the Hebrew into the Greek. This, of course, is Old Testament. And although he wrote in Greek, wherever the word Yahweh occurred, he used the four Hebrew letters, equivalent to our English YHWH, in his manuscript. It was intended to replace the Septuagint, but it was a practically literal translation of the Sopharim Hebrew text into Greek. Now, the idiom of the two languages is considerably different, so this made it such poor Greek that it never became popular. But it is valuable evidence as to what the Sopharim text was, even that early. It's quoted a number of times in writings of the early Christian fathers, and some fragments of it still exist. Symmachus, about 180 A.D., made a translation into Greek, and he didn't try to make it a literal translation. It was a very free translation. He was trying to convey into Greek idiom the Hebrew thought to make it good Greek, and he did a good job of it. It's quoted by the early Christian fathers, and some fragments of it still exist. Around that same time, about 180 A.D., Theodotion made it wasn't really a new translation. It was a revision of the Septuagint to put it into better Greek rather than a new version. Quite well done. Parts of it have been quoted by early Christian fathers. No fragment of it remains today. There were three other translations, evidently fairly commonly used, their authors unknown, ranging from around 180 to 200 A.D. Pretty good Greek style. Fragments only exist. Then finally, you have the Hexapla by Origen. Now, what he did, on each page he put six parallel vertical columns, because he was giving a comparison of six versions, so you could see where the similarities and differences were. Column 1 was the Sopharim text of the Hebrew. Column 2 was the Sopharim text, but transliterated into Greek. I don't mean translated, I mean simply the sound of the Hebrew reproduced in Greek letters, as near as you had Greek letters for the same thing. Not trying to give the meaning in this case, but so somebody who read Greek would be able to pronounce it as it was pronounced in Hebrew. Column 3 contained Aquila's translation. Column 4, Symmachus' translation. Column 5 was the Septuagint, as revised somewhat by Origen. And column 6 was Theodotion's translation. Now, of course, this was an enormous work. It contained some 6,500 pages. Obviously, all manuscript handwritten, because printing wasn't known for many, many centuries yet. So you never got this published, generally. Only one was known to have been made, and that was put in the library at Caesarea. Jerome, studying there when he was working on his Vulgate Latin translation, Jerome mentions having studied this hexaplet in Caesarea in the 4th century. It was presumably destroyed when the Saracen Arabs captured Caesarea in 638 A.D. Now, you come to the Aramaic. Now, as far as the Old Testament is concerned, I don't imagine there's any particular importance to the Aramaic, because the Aramaic was not used in Palestine as the general language until after the Babylonian captivity. You had the Sopharim text of the Hebrew adopted and recognized as official from only a little bit later than that. So I wouldn't expect to find in an Aramaic Old Testament any significant difference from the Hebrew. The Hebrew that they would have to put into Aramaic, and it would have to be a translation into Aramaic for the Old Testament, it would be the same Hebrew manuscripts on which what we have today are based. But for the New Testament, it's quite important. Aramaic was a Semitic dialect related to Hebrew, but not identical with it. Aramaic was spoken all over Western Asia. It was the language back in the Babylonian Assyrian area, and one of the languages commonly spoken way out in the west, even in Palestine. Now, Eastern Aramaic was divided into two slightly varying dialects. There was the Northern Aramaic, which was Assyrian, and the Southern, which was the Babylonian Chaldean variety. Out in the west, up in Galilee and Syria, you had the Assyrian or Northern Aramaic, and down in Judea, you had the Babylonian Aramaic. Now, even today, you have no difficulty recognizing a New England Yankee or a Mississippian by the difference in his speech. In England, you get some of these people from Yorkshire and so on, and you can hardly understand them, although they're speaking what they consider to be English, and no doubt it is. So you can see how there can be these various dialects. Now, all the apostles, except Paul, were Galileans. They spoke this Northern Aramaic. And you remember when Jesus Christ was arrested and brought to the high priest's home, Peter was recognized as being probably a follower of Christ because he was a Galilean, by his accent. Not that they couldn't understand each other, but there was enough difference that, as I say, as you can tell whether a man's a New England Yankee or a deep Southerner, there were these differences that gave them away. Now, in the New Testament, all the idioms, all the manner of thought and speech are definitely Aramaic. Everything in the New Testament was unquestionably spoken originally in Aramaic, and all the real evidence is that it was written in Aramaic. Now, George Lanza, who learned Aramaic as his native speech and who has translated the Aramaic into English, he has put out a complete Aramaic Bible at his Old Testament also. I've only gotten his New Testament because I think that's the only place that makes a difference. But I am very much pleased with it. Where you find differences between the translations based on the Greek and the translation from the Aramaic is always clearer and makes better sense. Now, you've heard me many times rave about Paul's writing, how he sometimes is practically incoherent in the translations from the Greek. But in the translation from the Aramaic, Paul is clear and makes good sense. In other words, Paul got messed up when they translated him into Greek. The claim that all Western Asia had a Greek culture is made only by those who pretend to be learned and are in fact ignorant. Now, Alexander conquered Asia with 45,000 Macedonian and Greek troops, plus natives enlisted in his army. After he had conquered one nation, he would enlist as many as he could of their fighting men in his army, so he had a bigger one to go on and conquer the next nation with. Now, this was purely a predatory military plundering expedition. It had no missionary purpose of any kind. They weren't trying to spread Greek religion, Greek culture, Greek language. They were out to see what they could steal. Nothing more. The Greeks, beginning with Alexander, held Western Asia for three centuries, but they did not succeed in imposing their language or customs, except, you might say, right along the Mediterranean coast. Western Syria, yes. Egypt, yes. Deep in the interior, no. Now, the Romans then came along, conquered almost the same area, not quite as far east as Alexander went. They held Asia for five centuries, and they had far better organization and administration than Alexander ever dreamed of, and there wasn't any place in all of Asia that adopted Latin as its language, not in five centuries. Then the Saracen Arabs ruled for six centuries, and because Arabic is another Semitic dialect, closely related to Hebrew and Aramaic, Arabic was adopted as the language in some places in Asia, while in many other places, the people would speak Arabic for what public purposes were necessary, and they still spoke Aramaic in their homes and their own businesses. Then the Turks ruled all that area for six centuries, and they never succeeded in imposing Turkish language or Turkish customs upon the people. So the idea that this little military plundering expedition turned all these people of Western Asia into enthusiastic Greeks is simply not founded on fact. Christian churches were founded long before Paul's time. His work and his letters date from the mid-50s to the mid-60s A.D. And he tells you before his conversion, he was running around trying to stamp out these churches everywhere, even going as far as Damascus. These churches had been based on teachings they got from Aramaic Gospels. Nobody claims today that Matthew was written any later than 37 A.D., and they all admit that Matthew was originally written in Aramaic. With this, the conversion began. Now, Paul's first missionary journey was only to cities that were on the Asiatic mainland, as was also his third. In his second missionary journey, he did go to one city in Macedonia, Thessalonica, and to two cities in Greece, Corinth and Athens. But where did he go? Read the book of Acts, and it tells you that always when he went, even to Athens, he headed first for the synagogue. Greek paganism and Roman paganism were bitterly hostile to Christianity. The idea of going there and getting on a soapbox and starting to convert these pagans is simply ridiculous. He had to get himself some start, and the place that would listen to him, at least until they found out whether they disagreed with him or not, was in the synagogues, because Paul always started out trying to show them that Jesus Christ had fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies. That was the proof that he was the Christ, the Messiah, and none of the pagans had even heard of the Old Testament. So, the great probability is that Paul's letters, even to Corinth and the rest of them, were written originally in Aramaic and translated into Greek. The big process of translating into Greek occurred after the Emperor Constantine was converted to Christianity. You remember, he made his capital city Byzantium, later Constantinople, and they were trying then to use the Greek culture to build it up with and to make converts among the Greeks. And from then on, you really had some major effort to translate the scriptures into Greek. Now, as to the Aramaic, basically, the Peshitta, it's a word that means simple, clear, and original or genuine. It's the Aramaic text, which everybody admits was written during the first century A.D. And the final form of the Peshitta is an Aramaic canon, definitely settled about A.D. 150. It omits several books that are in the Greek Old Testament, so you can see definitely it was not copied from the Greek. And furthermore, all known copies of the Peshitta agree. You don't have the differences that you find between various Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Another reason for greater accuracy is the fact that the Eastern Church, Syria and Babylon and Persia, they lost all contact very early with either the Greek or Roman Catholic Church. From the time of the Arab uprising about the late 620s A.D., they were totally cut off from all contact with the West. So all the bitter controversies that arose between the Greek Catholic and the Roman Catholic Church over differences in doctrine were never even heard of where the Aramaic was spoken. With those controversies going on, there were some deliberate forgeries of manuscripts made by the monks in the monasteries copying them in order to support their differences in doctrine, but you never got any reason for forging the manuscript in the Aramaic. As I say, I was extremely well impressed with Lamsa's translation from the Aramaic. Then the manuscripts in Latin. Now these obviously had to be translations. First, the Old Latin. It was translated out of the Septuagint into Latin, probably at Carthage, in the 2nd century A.D. Its influence was short-lived. It was superseded a couple of centuries later by Jerome's Vulgate. Jerome made this translation into Latin between 383 and probably about 410 A.D. I don't mean we're uncertain when he worked on it, but it took that long for the process to become complete. It became the official Bible of the Catholic Church and still is to this day. It was revised somewhat in the 6th and the 9th centuries. It has some differences, of course, between it and the Protestant version, because Jerome was based on the Septuagint, Vulgate based on the Septuagint, and there were, as I said, a number of substantial differences between the Hebrew and the Septuagint. Now coming to translations into other European languages, they began early before the Catholic Church succeeded in stamping it out. In the 15th century, now remember the 15th century begins with 1401 and ends in 1500. In the 15th century, a complete Bible, Old and New Testament, an anonymous work, went through 18 editions in Germany. Then Martin Luther made his translation, 1523 to 1534, based on the Vulgate for the Old Testament and Erasmus' Greek manuscript for the New Testament. Well, now, Erasmus' work was extremely faulty. He had access to only 10 Greek manuscripts. They were all very late, and all of them quite faulty, so the Greek edition that Erasmus published proved to be quite unreliable, but it was all they had. In Holland, Jacob van Liesveld published a Dutch translation of the Bible, 1526. In France, Olivetan, in 1535, issued the first Protestant version of the Bible. Old Testament based on the Hebrew, New Testament on the Greek. In Spain, in the 13th century, there was the Castilian Old Testament translated from the Hebrew. In 1569, Reyna translated a complete Bible. Now, of course, the Catholic Church soon put a stop to all this, but it shows how people wanted to learn what was in the Bible. In Italy, Malerbe, in 1471, put out a complete Bible, and that was the earliest printed Bible. You remember, it was in the early 1500s that Martin Luther got out his translation. Ruccioli in 1532 put out a complete Bible, and in 1607 Diodati put out a complete Bible in Italian. and his is still receiving some use there. As to early English translations and versions, prior to the 14th century, there probably was no complete Bible in English. But in the 7th and 8th centuries, portions were translated. Egbert, his work is still in existence. Aldhelm and Bede, their work has been lost, no surviving copy. In the 10th century, the Lindisfarne Gospels, translated out of the Old Latin, and Elfric translated parts of the Old and New Testament from the Vulgate. And after that, there were several other translations of parts of the Bible. Complete Bibles in English begin with Wycliffe. His was published between 1379 and 1388. It existed in manuscript form only until 1850, the first time it was printed. But 170 of the old manuscript copies are still in existence. It was based on the Vulgate. For some mysterious reason, he was not martyred by the Catholic Church. But in 1428, the Pope ordered his bones dug up and burned so there'd be no trace of him remaining. Then Tyndale, and that's the great name in English Bible translation. He was murdered at the instigation of the Catholic Church in Belgium in 1536, but he had done his work. His Old Testament, based on the Hebrew, is New Testament on Erasmus Greek. And Tyndale discovered the great similarity between Hebrew and English idioms. He said, in translating from Hebrew into English, it is rarely necessary to do anything but just make a literal word-for-word translation. To try to translate from Hebrew into Latin is very difficult because of the difference in idiom. You have to use a very roundabout way of getting the thought in Latin, and usually you can't get it accurately. But he said there is a natural affinity between the Hebrew and the English language, much greater than between the Hebrew and the Greek, the Hebrew and the Latin, or the Greek and the English. In the King James Version, 80% of the words in the New Testament are Tyndale's. It shows you what a remarkable work he did. The English church authorities burned all the copies they could seize, but by 1528, 18,000 copies had been printed, and of course it kept on at great volume. They were smuggled into England because, of course, the English priesthood were in every respect as bad as any of the other Roman Catholic priesthood. They wanted their monopoly. No one should be permitted to read a Bible because then he would decide for himself what it meant, and only the priest had the privilege of deciding what the Bible meant. Then comes Coverdale. He published his in 1535. It was really a revision rather than a new translation. He was not any great student of ancient languages, but he did have a very fine command of the English language, and as far as he could be sure of the meaning from the Hebrew and Greek, he put it into good English. Then what was called Matthew's Bible, published in 1537. The work of John Rogers. To avoid the bitter controversies over Tyndale, he called this Matthew's Bible. It was really nothing but a revision of Tyndale, plus some small additions from Coverdale. But now this Matthew's Bible is the basis for all subsequent revisions of the Bible, everything other than a brand new translation. Matthew's Bible was very popular, but in the form in which it was published, it wasn't elaborate enough to suit the church authorities. So they published the Great Bible, basically Matthew's, but just a fancier edition. And that was officially adopted for church use until the reign of Bloody Mary. Now this, of course, was a work about the size of the Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, and it was chained to the pulpit in the church, but members of the congregation could read it there at the church. Then, in 1539, Taverner put out a version. The Old Testament was taken from Matthew's Bible, but he retranslated the New Testament. A few of his words are found in the King James Version. Then the Geneva Bible. During Bloody Mary's reign, the Protestant reformers all had to flee from England because she was having them burnt at the stake as fast as she could get them arrested. So they fled to Geneva, and there they put out this Geneva Bible. The Old Testament was based on the Great Bible, which is practically Matthew's, as I said, and the New Testament was based on Tyndale. Its English was scholarly, idiomatic, forceful, a pretty good work, except, of course, it had the errors that were in the original manuscript, because Tyndale, of course, had nothing but Erasmus' Greek New Testament to work from. Then the Bishop's Bible, published in 1568. That was the official Church of England version. They tried desperately to suppress the Bible by burning all they could get hold of and murdering the translators and so on. They couldn't stop it, so they decided finally to put out their official version. But actually, it was just a revision of Matthew's Bible plus some small amount from the Geneva Bible. That was used for some 40 years. Then in 1609, the Catholic Douay version was published. The Catholic Church had become quite alarmed at the English translations, which all reflected the Protestant point of view. Because an honest translation of the Bible can't reflect the Catholic point of view. There are too many paganisms in Catholicism. So, the Catholic Church decided to put out their own English translation, which would be suitably tailored to reflect Catholic views. It was based on the Latin Vulgate, but the Catholic translators were so impressed with the sacredness of the Vulgate, actually it was a sacrilege to translate it at all and not leave it in the original Latin of the Vulgate. So they did kind of a hit or miss job on it, and particularly they followed the literal Latin so closely, where the idiom is greatly different from the English, that basically it's a poor job in English, altogether aside from any doctrinal differences. It is still the authorized version for English-speaking Catholics, although now it is not the only authorized version for the Catholics, because Knox's translation is now also authorized. Then the King James Version, 1611. A committee of 54 revisers were appointed, and their orders were given. The Bishop's Bible is to be as little changed as the truth of the original will permit. Unless you say that something in the Bishop's Bible is just outright false, you can't change it. You've got to leave it as it was. But what they actually did, it was a revision of the Great Bible, this big one, and that in turn was only a revision of Matthew's, which was a revision of Tyndale plus a little of Coverdale. So that basically Tyndale is the man who gave us our English Bible. Well, the known errors in it, as we found later, not known to be errors at the time of the translation, but we have today more than 100 times as many really ancient Greek manuscripts from which to judge how these words were used in ancient times. More than 100 times as many as were available to the translators of the King James Version. And it includes many much earlier manuscripts which don't have the errors that crept into the later ones. The English Revised Version was published from 1881 to 1885. Again, their instructions were the King James Version was to be altered as little as possible. In the New Testament alone, they made 5,788 changes, however, based on the older and better Greek manuscripts now available, plus some instances in which obsolete English words, which had lost their old meaning, were replaced by modern English. About 10 years later, you have the American Revised Version, which is very slightly different. It makes a few more changes. Now when you come to modern English translations, Phillips, very readable, written in beautiful, clear English, and it's only a paraphrase. To the extent that Phillips correctly understood what the original meant, Phillips is right. And to the extent that Phillips may have been mistaken, Phillips is wrong, because this is not the Gospel according to Matthew, it's the Gospel according to Phillips, as any paraphrase must be. Sir R. Fenton. Accuracy really very high, and clear, readable English. Now, the thing at which I take issue with any of these translations is this. These translators will practically all say, I'm trying to get the general sense of it clear in English. And no one word of itself means anything in particular to me, or we'd put several verses together to make a paragraph in English. And as I understand it, the general thing he was talking about was this. They don't recognize that a single word, which may have made them wonder a little bit and perhaps change it to get smoother English, a single word may have been put in there because it had a special significance. And they will not alter the smoothness of their English translation in order to render that one particular word accurately. And sometimes that one word is extremely significant. And the original used that one word for a purpose. And that's why I've told you I cannot recommend any modern English translation as being 100% accurate. Smith and Goodspeed, again, pretty high accuracy, good readable English. Rotherham, now very high accuracy, but it leads to rather awkward English phraseology. A good work for study to make sure what it's all about, but I don't normally quote from it because the English is awkwardly phrased. Young's literal translation. It's very useful. Sometimes the order of wording in the Hebrew is different from that in English. You wouldn't just translate word for word if you were going to use it as I do in a broadcast. But even that gives you some indication of how they thought in the old languages. The New World Translation, published by the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's clear, apparently a careful job of translating, but again, I would say there are times when they miss the special significance of some words that we've given attention to. And finally, Lamsa, L-A-M-S-A, George Lamsa's translation from the Aramaic. He admittedly follows the language of the King James Version in many places where he feels it's correct. There is no difference between that and the Aramaic in that particular verse. But wherever the Aramaic differs, he translates exactly as the Aramaic is written. And every point that I have found thus far where the Aramaic differs from the King James Version based on the Greek, the Aramaic is clearer and makes better sense. As I said, even Paul's writings become clear, simple, and make good sense in the Aramaic. That's where your Bible came from, and that's the various principal forms that we have it in today.
You have been listening to a message by the late Pastor Bertrand L. Compre from his sermon titled Bible Origins. If you would like a complete tape or MP3 CD of this talk, ask for it by name with the number 128, and send a donation to cover our costs and help with radio time. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.